session number 14582, Rule 3.
Stephen Dale, Rule 3.
Well, this relatively young-looking man was the rabbi, and he had a very powerful personality because he was an Orthodox man, and quite a number of his flock from Altona, which is a part of Hamburg, were with him. Well, they weren't with him, but they were also there. And they were really living under kosher conditions, which meant that the food that was represented, caused them problems. And he made it absolutely clear to them all. He said, you must eat what you're given to eat because your first duty is to survive. And you can't survive if you don't eat. So eat whatever they present you with, whether it revolts you or not, you must stay alive. And of course, that was quite sensible. It assuaged the fears of many of his flock, because it made it quite clear to them where their duties, such as in the circumstances, were lying. And he was a marvelous man. One couldn't help admiring him. I don't know what happened to him, but I even forgot his name. Each block had a block leader. In our case, it was a political prisoner, a man called, I remember his name, Walter von Schwichow. he was quite a powerful personality, and he helped to keep morale up tremendously by his sheer presence and the way he talked to people. Food was adequate, as far as food value is concerned, certainly volume-wise, all right. It didn't worry us greatly what we had to eat, as long as we had something to eat, because everybody was preoccupied with surviving. We were marched out to work, such as it was. It wasn't really any very constructive work. I think they were concerned with organizing us and learning lessons for future reference. I don't know how many thousands of people there were at Sachsenhausen. I just don't know. But suddenly, there was a very cold snap, and people suffered tremendously being with inadequate clothing out in the cold. The temperature was, I would say, 16 centigrade below freezing. And little things stick in my mind, like they had horses in one of the so-called workplaces, and they were... And it was lovely to see these horses there because they were completely unaffected by the depression that reigned among the inmates of Sachsenhausen, and equally, they were impervious to the guards who were obviously pretty horrible, and they were just sort of standing there in the cold and having work. They got hot, of course, and they were steaming and sort of stamping the frozen ground. And it was somehow sort of an endearing situation. Having these animals that are completely impervious to what's happening around them, or oblivious, and not being concerned with our sort of preoccupations. One fellow collapsed on the way when we were about to go home, and we tried to carry him, four of us, and that wasn't very comfortable, and then two of us tried to carry him, and that we couldn't get on with that either, because we were marching in columns. And so they put him on my back. And I carried him, I forget how long. I was very lucky because he wasn't terribly heavy, so I could cope. In any case, I was quite sort of, call it athletic for want of a better word in those days, and I could cope with that sort of situation.
What sort of work were you doing?
Digging. I forget what we were digging. It's quite extraordinary. I've got a memory of one of the... Obviously, they had to occupy us, so they made us run between two points in relays, two groups of people sort of facing each other, and then one from you, and sort of running, I don't know, 30, 40 yards or something like that, one after the other. And there was one man who was rather older than we were, and he was terribly, terribly upset by that, because he kept on shouting, "I was an officer in the last war, and this is how you treat me now." And I mean, I think it was an affront to his dignity, apart from the fact that it was also exhausting for him. And I was sorry for him, but no more than I would have been sorry for anybody else. I mean, it was just sort of one feels sorry in circumstances like that on a communal basis rather than in respect of individuals. Because, I mean, we were all in the same mess. And we were sorry. I was sorry for that man, but that the degree was relatively minor, because the greater feeling of being sorry was for all of us, for the lot of us. There were two roll calls a day, and in that cold weather we sometimes had to stand I don't know for how long. And the actual counting was pretty quickly. And the people who were there were the guards, but the guards also had inmates to take over certain duties. They were like foremen, and many of those had green triangles, which denoted that they were criminal inhabitants, right? Jews had yellow triangles. Political prisoners had red ones. Gypsies, brown, and homosexuals, pink. And of course, the foremen, so to speak, were either criminals or political prisoners. Never gypsies, never homosexuals, never jurors. So there was, even within the camp, there was a grading of a degrading of inmates. It's extraordinary. I mean, that was 1938, and some of the things are very vivid in my mind. Other people will remind me of it if one has an opportunity of talking about it. But what was appalling was the public flogging of offenders. You're liable to be flogged for all sorts of things, and it was done at roll call time. And it was really pretty ghastly.
Who would have done that?
Oh, the SS. The SS guards. They did the flogging.
And how severe would that have been?
Pardon?
How severe would that have been, the flogging?
Well, I've never been flogged, but I mean, if you get 6 or 12 strokes or something like that, I mean, with a hazelnut rod, and I believe it was covered in leather or something like that. It was pretty grim.
And would that have been on bare flesh?
I can't remember. You could hear it. I don't think so. I honestly don't think so. Well, I don't think it matters, you know. I mean, I'm not trying to poo-hoo it. If you're if you are beaten very, very severely with that sort of implement, I mean, probably on the naked flesh it would have been worse.
Were you ever beaten?
No.
Were you roughed up?
I was beaten, yes, but not flogged like that.
Is it difficult when you are beaten not to hit back? You know, you were saying you were athletic and a very independent character from what you've been saying. Was that a very difficult situation for you to be in a under people's control, as it were, and not being able to?
I'd like to believe that I'm an individualist in many ways, but you don't feel like an individual if you are in a group of people who are exposed to the same misery, dangers, and whatever. I didn't take to it gladly or kindly, obviously not, but perhaps it was easier for me to have a degree of, I don't know, call it discipline for want of another word or better word. You are part of a larger unit. It's probably like an ant heap, you know, or a beehive, where the individual is however painful things will be or are. I mean, you submerge yourself. I mean, I've had similar situations later on in life where however strongly you feel, you become an integral part of a larger unit, and it's no good trying to give vent to your selfish manifestations of individuality. I don't know whether I'm making myself clear here.
Is it perhaps a way of surviving, you know, to do that, do you think?
Survival? Yes, I'm sure it is. Because the urge to survive is, of course, I mean, you don't think in those terms, but it's there all the time. I mean, you instinctively try and, I mean, for instance, in a concentration camp, you submerge yourself because you don't want to attract attention, right? The moment you do, you're liable to be picked on. I mean, there was a situation on one occasion when we were stopped, a number of people were stopped by an SS officer, and he asked a question, and somebody made a noise, and he was standing there with his back to us when that happened, and he whipped round and he said, "Who made that noise?" And he looked at the fellow, actually, who did make the noise. And he went up to him and said, "Did you do that?" And he said, "No," pointing at me, "he did." So I didn't protest because I didn't see any point in protesting. But he took he put on his black leather gloves, and then he started to hit me. He hit me with his right hand on my left ear. And I forget how often, but I was completely numb. And it's no good protesting in circumstances like that. It's no good saying, "No, I didn't do that." I mean, what are you achieving? I mean, that was a few days before I was released. And I couldn't hear. I couldn't hear a thing out of my ear. I mean, through my ear. And when I got out of Sachsenhausen, a few days later, my ear started to ooze, and it was inflamed, and all this was rectified, but the doctor who looked at it then told me that my eardrum had burst, and it wasn't surprising, but again, it's not something which affects me today physically at all, except that when I had my ears syringed, I warned the person who syringes my ears that I had a burst eardrum, and then they looked and said, oh yes, I can see the scar. That really is not a...
I wondered also, this sort of procedure which you've explained of having a striped uniform and having your head shaved, what that does to you. Does that also help you to become one of this mass?
Yes, of course. Yes, you're right. I mean, it does. You become a member of a group of people who've lost their individuality. I mean, from looking at it from the outside. Obviously, you remain an individual. But you're part of a mass of other individuals, which becomes sort of amorphous, you might say.
Does it have an effect, do you think, on your sort of psychological state? Did you feel...
It's difficult for me to say that, anything about that today, because, I don't know what I would have been like if that sort of thing hasn't happened.
I was wondering if you felt sort of degraded in any way.
Oh, yes, one felt degraded. But, one felt, indeed, it is. To lose your liberty and to be in the power of other people must be degrading to the vast majority of people. I suppose if you haven't got any individualism or backbone or whatever you like to call it, then you wouldn't be so terribly affected by it. But it is very degrading. But there's something else to it all. It makes you appreciate what you can put up with. It's not a very... you might say that's a positive result, but not one would particularly try to sort of to strive at.
Is also the uncertainty a very sort of bad aspect of this?
The uncertainty of not knowing how long is this going to last is pretty awful. But at the same time, it is also immediate survival is paramount. And after that, you say to yourself, how long is it going to last? How long is it going to last? Can I survive it? And my goodness, I was 22 and 21. I wouldn't like to say it was not problematic, or on the contrary, it was all terribly, fraught with all sorts of fears and apprehension. But in essence, it does also show you what you can put up with if you have to. And other people have been through similar situations. During the Blitz in London, people put up with tremendous hardships night after night, but you learn to live with it. Whether you like it or not, it becomes a way of life. But it happens all the time. We've seen enough of documentaries about Vietnam, how perfectly decent, nice American soldiers became dehumanized and did things which they couldn't conceive of ever doing.
Your release when it came, was that very sudden?
Oh, yes, very sudden. It's very funny, actually. because we were, there was a group of people were released from Sachsenhausen, and it was shortly before Christmas, I forget the date, and we were given our clothing back. And it had been tied up very, very tightly into small bunch of string, you know, obviously, because they wanted to have the maximum, minimum amount of space occupied by thousands of people's suits, coats, hats, whatnot. And when I undid the string, there was my jacket, and you can't imagine what it looked like. It obviously been through a dry cleaning process, and then they tied it up very, very tightly, and it was creased beyond, I mean, it just incredible the way it looked. And you know, I had it cleaned, dry cleaned afterwards, my jacket and trousers, and they never regained their shape. These creases never came out. But this is just a little sidelight. What was important, I had a jacket, a green sports jacket, and trousers, and a shirt, and like that, with my shaven head, a large number, I don't know how many, whether we were 10 or 20 or 25, we got onto the train to Berlin, and all the people on the train knew where we were coming from, and they were all avoiding eye contact. We were all looking elsewhere. We weren't there as far as they're concerned. And I arrived in Berlin, and it was after midnight, and I felt I couldn't ring my parents, so I rang Rudy, my friend Rudy, who by that time had married Jin. I can talk to her about her in a moment. And I went by underground to see them. But they asked, said, come immediately. See, and they had this small flat, and they had things sort of prepared for Christmas. You know, there was a tree there, and presents, and food, and whatnot. And we sat, and we must have been sitting there for, well, I mean, I arrived there probably at midnight, and we were sitting there until the morning talking. it was therapeutic, you know, this sort of, it was marvelous. They opened all their sort of Christmas preparation, I mean, the food they had prepared for Christmas, and we were enjoying that. And Jin, that's Rudy's wife, her name is Inge, but there was another Inge in our group of people, so she had to have another name, and so she became Jin, I don't know how. And Jin was sort of looking at my head and said, good Lord, you've got dandruff. And there was my virtually bald head. I mean, my hair couldn't have been more than an eighth of an inch long or something like that. And I said, yes. Ah, she said, I've got some treatment for that. And she walked out of the room and came back a moment later, and she cracked an egg on my bald head and massaged it in, saying that I know that's good for dandruff, or against dandruff. I don't know whether I did anything or not. Next morning, Rudy gave me a suit, and I went to see rang my parents, and I went home. By that time, my sister was no longer at home. She had left on the 12th of December with the first children's transport to England. But my brother was there, and my parents, of course. Of course, they were glad that I was back. There was no doubt happy I was back. But you know, it's never been a very demonstrative relationship. Extraordinary. I suppose they couldn't help themselves. It's not that they didn't feel anything, but it just wasn't there. I don't know.
How are they faring? You know, this is the end of 1938, isn't it?
How
are they getting on, your parents? You know, it was a bad time.
They were just existing. I mean, my father didn't. I mean, my father did sort of odd jobs, you might say. I mean, he was an extraordinarily handy man. He could do anything. I mean, he sort of made his own radio sets or anything mechanical which he needs puzzling out. I mean, he did that beautifully. I mean, he coped with that very readily, and it gave him a source of enjoyment. So what he could do virtually any repair job. But there was little work from. I don't know how they existed then.
Was there any sort of thought of trying to leave the country regarding your parents?
I mentioned to you before that they were not frightfully effective in their ways of coping with life. Once it was all derailed by the circumstances, they couldn't adapt very readily. And by the time that the reason why I was released from concentration camp, I found out later, was because I had a permit, and I don't know how I got it at the time, a permit to go to England as an agricultural labourer. And this enabled me to see my way clear to go to England. See, and, I mean, my future seemed to be settled, you know. I can get out, because people didn't look or think beyond getting out of Germany in those days, certainly not people at my age, because I had nothing. If I'd been 10, 20, 30 years older and I had a business or a practice of law or medicine and a regular income and perhaps savings, or I owned a house or something like that, my philosophy would have been different. But in my situation, I had no other ambition but to get out of Germany. And when I got out of Sachsenhausen, I knew that I was going to get to England, what I didn't know at that moment, the time. Therefore, I was still hanging around. It was... looking back, I mean, my parents knew that I could get out then, except not mine, but they had never been able to formulate a way of getting out. It just wasn't in their makeup. They were victims. They were drifting along in this life without any, there was no obvious purpose anymore for them in their life. I mean, parents normally think about bringing up their children. I mean, when they have children, I mean, they want to see their children progressing. I mean, we've got grandchildren and we are happy when they got their A-levels, when they get their university degrees and all that sort of thing. And we want them to see in jobs, and we want them to have a purposeful life. And a satisfactory life. It wasn't like that at all. I mean, my brother eventually got a permit to go to England on the later children's transport, but it never materialized. He was then overtaken by the war. War broke out and he couldn't come. But that was 6 months later, more than 6 months later. And
But they did get your sister, as you've told me, on one of the earliest
yes,
children.
I think the first one. Well, my sister actually, I mean, is a quite a remarkable person. I mean, she arrived here and eventually landed up with a family in Wolverhampton father, mother, daughter, and son. They were, at one particular moment, they decided to take a refugee into their home and provide a a basis for a new life. And my sister was in a very fortunate position to get into their house, into their home. He was an inspector of taxes, which probably meant in those days that he had a sure future, not being very affluent, but I mean they had enough money to go once a year on holiday. They had their house and they ran a car, and they were decent, fairly decent, caring people, and they gave a home to my sister, who then made good. By sheer determination, she got to university eventually, got herself a degree in economics, commerce, at Nottingham University. And eventually she worked for a man called Professor Lewis in Manchester University. He was an economist. And he sent her to the West Indies for 3 months to look at to do some research. And when she came back, she handed
Oh, sorry,